Welcome, everybody. Tonight's shiur is Parshas Chukas. The title is Transforming Anger, Coping with Life Difficulties. We're going to begin with a famous clip, Madam Sandler. Let's go to the videotape. Hopefully this will work. Okay, it will not work. All right, so I'm gonna. Who's gonna share it? I'm gonna put it on the chat. Who could share it and share it with everybody with sound?
I can, if you want me to.
Yeah, please.
Okay, let's see the video. Let me pull it up before I share.
Make it full screen.
Oops, 1 second. Sorry, I just have to queue it up. Okay. Great. Then I lost Zoom. Okay. Let me close all other windows except for that one. Look good?
Yeah. Recording in.
Okay, let's watch.
Think so? You're my wedge.
Fine iron, huh?
Well.
You're fine.
Bye-bye. What? Happy riding a bull?
Yeah.
You're acting like a damn fool.
Doing the bull dance. Feeling the flow. Working.
On the 18th green, Shooter McGavin is putting for the win. Maybe it's just me, but his crowd seems unusually small for this type of moment. I think most people have found their way over to Happy Gilmore. He's been the talk of the course today with his huge drives and his amazingly bizarre behavior. He's on the 17th green right now, having a little trouble closing out his day.
Happy, the ball itself has its own energy, or life force, if you will. Its natural environment is in the hole. So why don't you send him home? His bags are packed. He's got his airplane tickets. Bring him to the airport. Send him home.
Send him home. Just send him home. It's time to go home there, ball.
Son of a bitch, Paul, why didn't you just go home? That's your home! Are you too good for your home? Answer me!
Suck my white ass, Paul!
Put out a press release concerning Happy Gilmore being thrown off the tour. I want to see a draft by 6 p.m.
You're right. He was out of line. His behavior is completely unacceptable. But you know, golf has been waiting for a player like this. A colorful, emotional, working-class hero.
I will not tolerate behavior like this. Gilmore is gone.
I just got a call from the Dallas Open. Their phones have been ringing off the hook with people who want to see Happy. They just sold out.
Already?
I know. He's a little rough around the edges. But let me work with him.
He's a monkey!
Okay. Fine. But he's your responsibility. If he cleans up his act, he can stay. If he doesn't, it's your ass. Any more of this?
Suck his cock! Oh! There you fucking lie, motherfucker!
And he's gone.
You pussy bitch! You fucking play it where it lies! Fuck you!
Okay.
Okay. All right. Stop sharing. If I can find the stop sharing button. All yours, Rabbi.
Classic scene.
Classic scene. Okay, so. Okay. Questions. How is Sandler emotionally explaining to himself why he failed?
He's not. He's taking it out on everything and everyone around him.
Exactly. Excellent point. In other words, he's not accepting that the fact that he missed the putt. He's accepting zero responsibility. He's throwing things. He's yelling at everybody. First of all, he's yelling at the ball. And then he's yelling at all the people thing. And he's throwing the flag. You know, he's going crazy. So he's not accepting any personal responsibility whatsoever. He's just lashing out at everybody. Okay. So after banging yourself on some piece of furniture, like stubbing your toe, have you ever hit the furniture in anger?
Yes. All the time.
Who has not done that at least once or twice? Right.
How dare you get in my way?
Right. How dare you put that piece of your why? How dare you put yourself right in the way where my toe was? And exactly. Now, what lesson are you trying to teach the furniture by hitting it?
Get out of my way.
Right. How dare you be in my way? What kind of chutzpah was that? Don't you know you're there to serve me? Why are you in my way? So what expectation about the world does this teaching a lesson to the furniture reveal?
It's narcissism. Everything around revolves around me.
Okay, well, that's true. But why is it, but what is it, why, how does it express itself in teaching the furniture a lesson?
It doesn't.
Well, I know it doesn't, but why are we doing it? Why are we giving it a potch?
Because it's just easy. It's the first thing you do. The easiest thing to do.
Yes.
To blame something else and not yourself.
Yes. And yes. And yes again. So, but basically, we relate to all, when we are angry, we relate to all things, including inanimate objects, as being sort of defying our will. We expect all the things in our world to conform to our wishes. This furniture, this couch had the audacity to be placed right where my toe was and cause me much pain. Therefore, it needs to be punished for its sin of being in my way. Now, this gets us to question number 5. In what sense is the angry person who hits the attacking furniture living in an enchanted world? When the angry person gives the attacking furniture, the couch, a potch.
Because obviously, like, you can't blame the couch or the chair for getting in your way. Like, it was always there. Or, yes. You know, maybe you should be looking down where you were walking. Or,
yes.
You know, accidents happen.
Yes. So, but in that moment, in that moment of anger, it really, at least on a semi-conscious level, we're living in it, you know, and what's it, first of all, what is an enchanted world? What does that term mean?
Fairy tale world.
Yes. A fairy tale, an imaginary with other, where the world works in a magical way. So in a magical world, the, like, you know, like Alice in Wonderland, like the teapots and the cups are all like have personalities, have a spirit, have an identity. So therefore, at that moment when we get angry, we revert back to a sense that the world, we are in an enchanted world where all the items are you know, should have a wisdom to relate to our will. So it's a, you know, we're in a magical world. So That's until we, you know, calm down. All right, so Moshe Chaim, please read the statement from the Rambam.
Certainly. This early sages said, anyone who becomes angry is like one who worships idols. They also said, whenever one becomes angry, if he is a wise man, his wisdom leaves him. If he is a prophet, his prophecy leaves him. The life of the irate is not true life.
Okay, so those are three loaded sentences of the Rambam, which the Rambam got it from, of course, the Talmud. He's just condensing it, consolidating it, condensing it, and making it concise. That's what his job is. Okay, so Question number six. How does the idol worshiper explain the relationship between the service to his deity and success? When he asks success, what's the relationship between the, you know, an idol worshiper, you know, bows or offers offerings to an idol?
False god brought me whatever success I have. Thank you, false god.
Yes. So, and not only that, it's because I worshipped or offered to this god, therefore I have this benefit, success.
Transactional.
Right, transactional, exactly. So question number seven, in what sense is the idol worshiper like the angry person living in an enchanted world?
I mean, it's that idea. I'm sorry. May I actually give someone else a chance to respond? Anyone else? Okay. Where was I going with this? Oh, right. It's the same thing when we say if we do things for God, if I do this, you'll do this, that type of thing. That thinking that we can control God through doing things. In this case, that we can control furniture through hitting it or getting angry at it so that it learns its lesson, or, you know, making that transaction with the false god, trying to control things in a elementary perspective.
Right. Trying to control, you know, creating a world where I have control. I can control furniture by hitting it to not get in the way so I don't stub my toe. I can control the gods by giving it gift or an offering, or be devoted to it, and therefore it will grant me success. Okay, so it's a world of magical. It's a magical world. So how does the shared living in an enchanted world explain why anger is equated to with idolatry? Let's take it to the next step, because Rama's quoting the Chazal. Anyone who becomes angry is like one who worships idols. That seems very on the surface. Seems very far-fetched, but that background doesn't make sense. All right, Moshe Chaim.
Sorry, I'm trying to compose the thought here. Okay. Explain how anger is equated with idolatry. Because when you're angry, I'm presuming that the anger in this case is not at an inanimate thing, it's at someone. If you saw understood the Tzelem Elohim, or even the got the, you know, the godliness in it, you wouldn't become angry. So you are living in an enchanted world and how you're reacting to it. Is that about right? Or no?
That is certainly true. But even less than that, when the person's angry, they sort of revert back to a earlier world, call that a childlike world, that sees the world working in a magical, enchanted way. So if I give a gift to the idolater, to the idol, to the false god, I will get something in return. Conversely, if I strike something or strike somebody, I will cause them pain, and they will do my wishes. In other words, it's the world where wishes come true. I want to live in a world where furniture does not cause me any pain, or nothing causes me any pain. Or I want to live in a world where I can control my success by manipulating, by transacting with this idol. The thing that is underlining both of them is a childlike, enchanted world where magical thinking operates. I hit it. I stub my toe. I kick the chair so it will not do it anymore. It will learn its lesson. That's a magical thought. It, as Scott pointed out, the chair does not have a mind or a consciousness to make a decision to get out of your way.
I don't know. Give AI a few years. That might change.
Right. A little AI application to it. and convert, and so too, the world of the false god is a world where I can have control and have my wishes come true. It's an enchanted world. So now, when should a person be angry or show anger?
When sticking up for yourself or defending someone else.
Why does that mean you have to get angry? Just protect yourself or others. So that doesn't require anger per se.
Unless the motivation for the deed has to do with anger, right? I mean, that's one of those things, right? We say, right, Hakinova Taibidva Kavod, right? Kino is jealousy, but there's a certain anger when a person's, right, if they lose themselves, right, they're angry, it costs. I'm just saying, there's all these chazals that say it's a bad midah, you know, but I would guess there's a certain type of anger geared towards Hashem, like we see by Pinchas. Maybe it's not anger, maybe it's Zerizos. I don't know what the word is, but
he was zealous for God.
Right, but I'm saying to have that extra motivation, he was angry at what was going on or frustrated, I would think, or he was just saying, no, that's wrong, and he did it with straight emotion, but there's a certain level of where anger has its place. Obviously, for us nowadays in our psychosomatic world, we want to heal and we need to feel, quote unquote. But back then, anger, you know, it's calm yourself down. It means you have a lack of emunah in Hashem if you're being angry. It means you're not accepting what's going on.
I would say that I'll offer a counterpoint. I don't think a person should ever be angry. But if you show anger with the intent of teaching someone something important in their interest, that might be an appropriate show of anger.
Correct. That's what the Ram says in the next couple sentences. I didn't quote that part. I wanted to see if you guys could.
I didn't cheat this time. Yeah.
No. I didn't let anybody cheat because I didn't show you the whole law. All right. The Ram says basically the goal, not so easy. The goal is, since you never want to be in an enchanted world, you never want to be in a magical world, you want to be in reality. So therefore, you never want to be angry. But there are times for educational purposes that you need to display anger. For example, imagine you have a young child. And they are about to put their hand into the flame. It's not a good time to say, honey, don't put your hand in the flame. You may want to up the volume and say, honey, what are you doing? You may want to yell at them just to make sure they do not harm themselves. Your goal is not that you feel anger. The goal is that you express anger so they will take your warning in a very serious way, or a child's about to step into traffic, you know, these types of things. Or you're trying to show, you know, students that what they're doing is incorrect or really not helpful. So you want to display, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that shortly. Moshe Rabbeinu and his talking to the Jewish people, which is this week's Parsha. So that's the goal. So Moshe Chaim Yashar Koach for that. You anticipate the Rambam's comments without even seeing it. Okay. All right. Let us go with that. One deed deserves another. Read. This is the story. I'm going to bring you up to date. Parshas Chukat, which is this week's Parsha, is in this Parsha, Torah skips the 38 years that the Jews wandered about in the Midbar. And now, because apparently there was nothing going on, there's nothing happening which is valuable for us to learn. And now we're now fast forward into the 40th year, the last year of their stay in the wilderness, before the next generation is going to go into the land of Canaan. So with that introduction, this is chapter 20, verse 1. Moshe Chaim does read it on behalf of everybody.
Awesome. The children of Israel, even the whole congregation, came into the Midbar of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves together against Moshe and against Aharon. The people strove with Moshe and spoke, saying, "We wish that we had died when our brothers died before Hashem. Why have you brought the assembly of Hashem into this wilderness that we should die here, we and our animals? Why have you made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is no place of seed or of figs or of vines or of pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Moshe and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the Mishkan and fell on their faces. And the glory of Hashem appeared to them. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, "Take the rod and assemble the congregation, you and Aharon your brother, and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it give forth its water. And you shall bring forth to them water out of the rock, so you shall give the congregation and their livestock drink." Moshe took the rod from before Hashem, as he commanded him. Moshe and Aharon gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring you water out of this rock for you?" Moshe lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his rod twice, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock drank. Hashem said to Moshe and Aharon, "Because you didn't believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. These are the waters of Meribah, because the children of Israel strove with Hashem, and he was sanctified in them."
Okay. So basically, as you just read beautifully, this is not the first time, but there's a water crisis. And the people are so frustrated, they say to Moshe, they say, "We wish we," you know, remember, this is the last year. The entire generation, people had died. They said, "We wish we died before. We wish we're dead." Okay, so you know, why did you bring now? And again, why have you brought us the assembly of Hashem out in the wilderness to die, us and our animals? And the same complaint they had before. Oh, when we came out of Mitzrayim, why did you bring us out here to an evil place? There's no place of seed or figs or vines or pomegranates or nothing to drink. So they give Moshe and Aaron some very harsh rebuke, a harsh complaint. So Hashem tells them to do something dramatic. Take the special matzah, which was in the Mishkan, gather everybody together before this big rock, and then he tells them to do what? Speak to the rock. Now, back in Beshalach, he tells him to hit the rock, which he does, and the water comes out. This is going to be even a greater miracle, okay? And you'll bring forth water from the rock, and you'll give everything a drink. So he takes it, and then he says to them, "Hear now, you rebels." Okay, so that's where he calls the Jews rebellious people. "Shall we bring you water out of this rock for you?" So he's yelling at them. He's frustrated with them. He's upset at them. In other words, they got to him. Even Moshe, you know, people could only stand so much. And even Moshe, the great, the master of all, you know, of Adonai Nevi'im, the master of all prophets, you know, he lost it. And it's funny, he does not say for water to come out. Just says he lifted up his hand. He struck the water twice. Then the water came shooting out. Okay. Then Hashem punishes them. "Because you didn't believe in me, Loham Mantembi, you didn't have belief or conviction or confidence." So, you know, I'm just giving synonyms, not a great word. It could have been a Kiddush Hashem, it could have been a great miracle. Then what is that situation? You will not bring the Jewish people into the land. So now the tragedy is Moshe is now being denied the fulfillment of his mission. His job was to redeem the Jews out of Egypt and bring them into the promised land. Hashem says, "You're not going to the promised land. You're ending here." So it's a pretty harsh punishment. Okay, so This is a very cryptic episode. The Or HaChaim, which is a commentary on the Mikros Gedolos and the Chumash, lists 12 theories. 12 theories of what was the sin of Moshe and Aaron. Okay? We can't do all 12 tonight. Okay. We're going to do one. Okay? So this is, let's take a look here. So, and I'm going to tell it to you, and I'm going to tell it to you, extemporaneously. Basically, the Rambam in Shmona Prakam basically says, what was Moshe's sin? So they might know.
I know several of those answers. But...
So the Rambam says the sin was he got angry at the Jewish people, and Hashem was not angry at the Jewish people. And the Jewish people thought, like, well, if we know that Moshe is a great man, if he's expressing that we're rebellious, that he's really communicating God's displeasure with us. So really, he communicated a false message. He was personally frustrated with them. He personally labeled them rebellious people. He basically lashed out at them because they just got to him. Okay. Now Moshe Rabbeinu, who's on a lofty level, and the Jewish people felt like, well, Hashem does not like us anymore. They felt that Hashem had rejected them. And that's why he's speaking to them so harshly, which was not the case, which was not true. And therefore, because of that, the fact that Moshe was, in a certain sense, making the mission of leading the Jewish people his personal agenda, in other words, he's upset at them. Hashem is not upset at them. So he and they believed if Moshe is communicating, it must be the case because he's the prophet. So therefore now Hashem basically punished Moshe by doing what? Firing him.
Can I ask a small question? I don't know if it'll go off.
Yes. Yes.
So in other places where the Jewish people complained and did stuff, they do get punished. In this case, Hashem doesn't even seem angry at them. He seems to just say, oh, this is a justified complaint and this is how we're going to solve it or something like that.
Yes.
Do we have any insight as to why the Jewish people weren't punished for their complaint this time?
You're actually becoming a defense attorney for Moshe. You're basically saying, what do you mean? Well, look what they said to him. We wish we had died in the when our brothers died before Hashem. Why have you brought us the assembly of Hashem into the wilderness that we should die here?
They've done this refrain before and they've been punished for it.
Right. So it seems to be that this is a harsh rebuke of Moshe and Hashem. So, but apparently Hashem wanted to deal with that. Hashem wanted to deal with their complaint in a dramatic fashion, namely by creating this. In other words, you think you're not beloved. You think that I'm indifferent to your situation. I'm going to dispatch my two prophets, Moshe and Aaron, and they're going to walk to the rock and they're going to say, bring forth water, and water's going to come out. So basically, because of his anger, instead of it being a great moment of reconciliation, of great appreciation of the Jewish people, Moshe got frustrated with them and then just whacked the rock, which is a lesser miracle because, you know, there is water within, you know, underneath the surface, and the So all right, so he tapped the right rock at the right time. Water came out. It was not a zero miracle, but it wasn't the grandiose miracle. And what was at least the Rambam's position is, what was the impediment? Moshe's anger. And that goes back to what we said before. Look what we read. Look, it says, whenever one becomes angry, if he's a wise man, his wisdom leaves him. In other words, we're going to get to some cases. If he's a prophet, his prophecy leaves him. In other words, if you get angry, and we're saying, when you get angry, you enter into your childlike, enchanted world, and your adult maturity of wisdom, and even if you were a prophet, a prophecy, is disconnected from you. That's why, as Moshe Chaim pointed out, you never want to be angry. You may on occasion want to display anger, but you yourself don't feel angry. Now, this is a very hard meta. I mean, I do not want to say this is easy stuff, but you got to know what to work on. You know what I mean? So this is the deal. Okay, I think we answered these questions. What was the state of mind of the Jewish people when they approached Moshe with a request for water?
Desperate,
and angry. They were angry. They were living in an enchanted world, and they were lashing out. What aspect of the request was Moshe respond to when he said, "Here now, you rebels, shall we bring you water out of the rock for you?"
Probably their anger.
Right. He's saying you're rebellious because you're expressing yourself in such an ungrateful and angry fashion. Now, again, what's his job as the leader of the Jewish people? He's there to be the ambassador, the spokesperson for Hashem. Hashem makes the calls. He feels that Hashem wants to not, he wants to address their issues, not matching anger with anger, but with anger with a glorious miracle in which they can be turned around. Why Hashem wants to do it in that way, obviously that's not, we can't know that, but he wanted to do take the high road. And Moshe's anger blocked that, because he was really super annoyed at these people, because this is the culmination. Remember, this is a good example of the straw that broke the camel's back. Okay, and so what was the, so I think we explained, what was Moshe's crime that he got punished so severely? By getting angry and not, at least according to the Rambam, and not being a conduit of the word of Hashem, that he wanted to blow them away with an amazing miracle. Therefore, the Jews thought that Hashem had rejected them, and that apparently is a terrible thing. And instead of being a Kiddush Hashem, he made it a Chil Hashem. And therefore, since he is being now, how does the punishment fit the crime? Why is not going into land? Why is the appropriate thing not going to the land of Canaan? Why is that an appropriate punishment? Like last time when Miriam spoke Lashon Hara, she got Saras and they had to wait out in the camp for 7 days. We'll give Moshe the same punishment.
Okay, so it looks like Scott left, so it's just me and Chaim. I mean, I've heard this explained as Moshe didn't live up to his own level. And because he kind of took himself out of the world in this place, his kind of dream of bringing the Jewish people into the land was part of the promise of God. So he didn't live up to what God asked him. So God didn't give him this, that something along those lines. And might be mincing my words a little.
So he didn't live up to his level.
Yeah.
So, according to that, he could be punished in many different ways. Why did he get to Ross? That would be a punishment. Why, you know, I mean, why didn't Hashem, you know, whatever, make him sick? There could be all kinds of different things. So apparently is that his mandate of being the leader of the Jewish people is, insofar as he is not leading them based upon his own emotional judgments, but basically based upon the instruction of Hashem. Here, his emotions, his anger, basically frustrated, thwarted the intent of Hashem. Therefore, is his role really about fulfilling Hashem's command or doing his own independent thing? So since he got overwhelmed, obviously, if you are a high level person, the punishment is much more severe than a regular person. So since he's co-opting the mission based upon his own feelings, therefore he's not going to be able to get the satisfaction of fulfilling the mission by taking the Jewish people in to the land of Canaan. All right, so let's finish up here with three practical takeaways and scenarios. Okay, number one. Scenario number one, Stacey M. Gier, a team member of a marketing department, was known for her passion and dedication. Let her anger take control during a team meeting. The trigger was a dismissive comment from a colleague, belittling the countless hours of hard work they had put into the project. The comment struck a nerve, making Stacey feel undervalued and disregarded. As her frustration grew, she went off on a passionate rant, exaggerating the situation and overshadowing all the progress the team had made together. The once positive vibes in the room quickly dissipated, and the atmosphere became tense, making it nearly impossible to regain a constructive, collaborative conversation. Based on the lessons learned from the Parsha, what should Stacey have done? What do you say, guys?
Measured response to the colleague that would have kept the team vibe positive, rather than kind of going off in this way that makes her feel better, but actually diminishes the goal of the team.
Right. This is the problem. We get angry when we get, quote unquote, triggered, because she was offended by that dismissive comment that they're not really working hard. She felt belittled and reduced. So therefore, she lashed out at the other person to attack them. Now, in doing so, all the goodwill and that collaborative spirit completely got drained out of the thing and now became a very super awkward team situation, which we have been in before. So you can see that so even though she crawled back into her enchanted world and believing if I yell at the people, that's going to solve the problem, it in reality did what?
Made it incredibly uncomfortable for everyone.
And then undermined her entire goal dramatically. So instead of solving a problem, she literally made the problem far worse. Now, what could she have done? When hearing the dismissive comment from the colleague.
I mean, she can either be more of a leader and be empathetic and put it beneath her, address it directly, or even pitch it over to the team for their feedback on whatever this comment was. Try to work it out as a team rather than her individually taking it all on herself.
Right. Or she could have had, after the meeting, pulled the colleague aside and said, by the way, I want to tell you that I was hurt and maybe others felt the same way when you made that dismissive comment that belittled all the hours of work that so many of us have made on the project. And maybe that was not your intent, but it really hurt. and just to share it like that. And the person would say, if they're big, you know, they say, I'm sorry. And instead of it making an awkward team situation, she could have solved the problem. Okay, scenario two. All right, Moshchem, read it out.
All right. In the midst of the tense family gathering, passive-aggressive statements reverberated through the room, adding fuel to Joe's growing anger. His aunt, with a faux smile, remarked, oh, I see you finally made it to one of our events. You were starting to think you had better things to do. His sister chimed in, it must be nice to have all the time in the world to focus on yourself while the rest of us are here juggling responsibilities. These comments were layered with sarcasm and thinly veiled resentment, striking directly at Joe's sense of worth and commitment. Each remark was a tiny dagger, pricking his emotions and intensifying his frustration. The cumulative effect of these passive-aggressive statements gradually pushed Joe to his breaking point, contributing to the outburst that followed. Based on the lessons learned from the Parsha, what should Joe have done?
This is not so simple.
Yeah. Let's see, you've got a sister and an aunt. So,
and you're at the family simcha. So we obviously know from the parsha that yelling at them all and blowing up is not, that's not going to help anything. So what can you do?
Not let it get to you, not, you know, try to, you know, depersonalize it or talk to them, as you said before, individually, try to work it out. And it doesn't
when?
After the simcha's done, not when in front of everyone, because that's not going to help.
Right. Right. Divide and conquer.
People will take sides.
Right. So, you know, endure the rest of the simcha, have an additional l'chaim, don't respond, and then, you know, afterwards say, and call them individually and say, you know, I see that you have a lot of there's a lot of resentment here, and I want to let's talk it out and allow them to vent and say, you know, and if Joe's wrong, now if Joe is wrong, he has to admit it, say, you know something, you're 100% right, or I understand that's how you feel, but let me show you another possibility. You know what I'm saying? You know, whatever the situation is.
Well, but this is obviously a long simmering thing, so this has a lot of roots to go back. So probably not that simple. And
of course not.
Yeah.
Right. So, to be having productive conversations versus a massive outburst at the simcha, and making the simcha be a yelling match, which, by the way, is like a classic Thanksgiving phenomenon. This happens at many, many people's houses on a Thanksgiving when this comes out. Okay. Last scenario. Go ahead.
All right. Jane M.J. Eater, known for her friendly demeanor among her group of friends, became increasingly frustrated when her opinions were consistently dismissed during a discussion. Feeling unheard, she gradually grew angry, sensing her emotions intensify with each dismissive remark. Instead of effectively communicating her concerns, Jane's anger reached a boiling point, causing her to erupt with hurtful words. Based on the lessons learned, what should Jane have done? Okay, so let's say this is like a Starbucks conversation and people are dismissive of her and she's getting angrier and angrier. I mean, she has
right, and she's with a circle of friends.
Yeah. So, I mean, first identifying within herself, is this what's triggering me and is it right to be triggered by it? Try to keep perspective and then figure out who's the best person in this group to talk to about this and diffuse it. She doesn't have to change everyone's ideas or, you know, she could let some of it go, but whatever is going to probably roll on from beyond this, she can address with a close friend in that group and try to change the dynamic a little bit.
Right. Right. Maybe, you know, but I like how you start with maybe people are being dismissive because their opinions are like, you know, are being extreme or is like inappropriate, or maybe she's speaking in an inappropriate way and she's getting a response, nor really she should. Now they're not maybe doing it nicely, but maybe the way that she's articulating it is she's alienating the people, and then she's getting a dismissive response because the nature of what she's saying it or how she is saying it, and to do a little self-evaluation. And B, I like your second suggestion is it after the event, after she sucks it up and not yell at them, speak to the most friendly or and wise and understanding friend and say, I don't know if you noticed, but when I offered an opinion or I shared my thoughts, they were constantly being rejected and reduced and dismissed. And I wanted to get your insight about why that's going on. Now, again, it's easier for us to say this, you know, because it's much easier to roll back into the enchanted world where if we simply yell at people, they'll automatically say, oh, you're right. Your comments were the wisest of all the comments. And instead of being dismissive, we should have given it a round of applause and a full appreciation.
I know, to some extent, I know that we never want to be angry or let ourselves be angry, but like I'll just personally say I had an instance recently where someone made me so upset, for good reason, mind you, that even though they weren't around, I found myself being very upset with them. I never brought that to them, but I kind of tried to let it be and then dissipate. So, I mean, if you're upset with someone, but you're not letting yourself show it to them, is that an acceptable behavior, or is that
no? Because there's. I'm so happy you brought that up. There is a mitzvah in the Torah which says, "Lo sisna es achicha belvecha," do not hate your fellow Jew in your heart. So let's say they acted in a manner which was mean, rude, dismissive, aggressive, and you were upset about it, but you didn't you suppressed it. There's a mitzvah from the Torah. There's a prohibition of being angry and not verbalizing it. And there's a positive commandment to try to broker a reconciliation, to talk to them about it. Now, if you upset yourself, but realize you say, you know something, I got that reaction. The truth is, I was wrong. You know, we are able to, all of us are wrong sometimes. So if you realize that you brought, you know, we brought this on ourselves, then that's one thing. But if you felt that they really acted inappropriately, you have to be able to, you know, have a private conversation where you share that, you know, of course you give them an out, like, I know you, that was not your intent, but it made me feel very bad. And in fact, I felt very angry, and a very angry response to the things that you said, which maybe you didn't intend to do so, but that made me feel very, you know, upset at you. And I want to have an open and honest relationship with you. And I want to be angry at you.
So even getting upset is actually worse than verbalizing it in a way, in that sense.
No, just the opposite. See, it's funny. There's two things. If you yell at them, then it's no longer hating them in your heart. But if you're angry, that's a, you know, so there, you don't want to be, or you want to be, if you get angry, that's a problem. We're trying to deal with that. And then to find a way to express to them in a productive, reconciliatory manner. So that's the challenge. These are some of the hardest mitzvahs.
Yeah, these are not easy.
Right. You know, kashrus and Shabbos are way easier than not hating certain people and the mitzvah of broken reconciliation.
I'll say anything that has to do with controlling our emotions is almost an intrinsically more difficult mitzvah than almost any other physical act that we can do that conditions us.
Correct.
We're just not that in tune.
Correct. Correct. But that's why what they call the tikkun hamidot, the refining of the character traits, is such an important mandate in Judaism. You know, A, because it creates social harmony, and B, if a person's emotionally harmonious and emotionally free, they're open to the wisdom of Hashem. Because they're not living in an enchanted, put it very simply, they're no longer living in an enchanted world. That's how it all works together.
Thank you, Rob.
But as a way to feel good, our greatest person in the pantheon of people, Moshe Rabbeinu, succumbed to anger. So therefore, you know, we are certainly going to succumb to anger. But the difference, what the goal is that we pick ourselves up, we analyze the situation, and we try to make the best decisions based upon that and improve incrementally for next time. We're a work in progress. We want to be a slightly better version of ourselves the next time. And Hashem is patient with that because nobody's born perfected. Moshe wasn't born perfected. We're not born perfected, and we have to work on ourselves. And you know, and even if you get angry, less angry 1% of the time, that's a huge accomplishment. So that's how challenging this is. But that's really the virtue. That's the virtue. All right, any questions?
I'm good, Chaim.